Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. How can a congregation focus intentionally on addressing the implicit racism within its own institutional and community life? Amanda Poppy, senior leader of the Washington Ethical Society, describes how her community has made anti-racism work an overarching priority, shaping its identity and congregational practices.
I'm Ann Michael. I'm the Associate Director of the Lewis Center for Church Leadership, and I'm also the editor of Leading Ideas newsletter. In this episode of Leading Ideas Talks, I'm going to be talking with Reverend Amanda Poppy, who serves as the senior leader of the Washington Ethical Society, a humanist congregation in the District of Columbia. Amanda's a graduate of Wesley Theological Seminary. She's an alumna of our Lewis Fellows Leadership Development Program, and she's ordained clergy in the Unitarian Universalist tradition. So welcome, Amanda.
Thank you so much. It is great to be here.
Yeah. So over the past several years, your congregation has been very intentionally taking on anti-racism work, examining how racism functions within the life of your own community. Can you begin by describing what you mean by anti-racism work and some of the goals of the work?
Sure, absolutely. And I think it's a great question because sometimes I'll talk with folks who feel as though, well, why anti? You know, that sounds negative. And I get that. They want to be for racial justice. They want to be for equality. I think the idea behind anti-racism work is that, particularly for those of us who, like myself, identify as white and are experienced by the world as white, right, we're either working actively against racism, against the systems of oppression in the world around us, or we are accidentally reinforcing it. Now, of course, we might actually be trying to reinforce it, but that's not the situation for most of the, you know, the folks in my congregation, and I suspect for your listeners. So if, in fact, we want to change the system of racism in our country, then we need to be actively working against it. So that's what we mean when we talk about anti-racism, being really engaged in working against racism as it occurs all around us, and especially as it occurs in systems.
Mm-hmm. And so specifically with regard to your work within your congregation, what are some of the goals of the work?
Mm-hmm. I think that, at the very beginning of this work and really my journey with the congregation, a lot of folks talked about wanting to be more diverse, more multicultural. It's a predominantly, although certainly not exclusively, white congregation, and folks wanted it to feel more like the city that we inhabit, you know. And although that would bring joy to me, I really tried to shift, and the team I worked with tried to shift the emphasis to being about how can we, as a predominantly white congregation, understand our own privilege, understand our place in systems of oppression, and particularly in racism in our country, and begin to shift that? Whether or not the demographic makeup of the congregation changes, there's work we can do in our own hearts and in the systems that we are part of in the congregation and wider that can move us toward a world that is more fair. Mm-hmm. More free from racism.
So I think in what you've just described, it's underscoring something that you have previously told me, mm-hmm. which is that a congregation can be multiracial,
yep.
but still be shaped by racist assumptions and practices.
That is absolutely right. I read an article a couple years ago that spoke precisely to this point. It was a survey of multiracial congregations in the United States, of which there are not that many, right? So just first of all, and I really imagined, oh, if you're a multiracial congregation, you must have figured it all out, right? And what the survey found was that people within those congregations still were caught, right? They were still trapped the way we are in racist systems, assumptions, unconscious bias, all of that stuff that is part of, you know, the air we breathe in America. And that unless the congregation was doing specific intentional work against racist systems and structures, it was caught the way all of us are caught. The same way you might have a workplace that's multiracial and still caught within racist systems and structures. That is true of a congregation as well. And for me, it really shifted. It helped to reinforce that shift in the goal.
Mm-hmm. So you may desire to become a multiracial congregation, but achieving that in and of itself does not necessarily mean that you've overcome racism. And
yeah.
that anti-racism work may be a necessary prerequisite to becoming multiracial, a helpful prerequisite, but not necessarily something that would automatically lead to a multiracial congregation.
I think that's right. I think we always have to keep in mind it's not about the numbers, right? It's not about just seeing more faces that look more diverse, quote unquote, right? Or more multiracial. And the thing that I love about that, although, you know, in some ways I think it's sort of like, oh, well, gosh, if you do the work, then you want this beautiful utopia you're imagining, right? And so it is important to keep the focus on the work. We're trying to change the system. You know, that's the important work. I think, though, there's actually like a little hidden gem there, which is that for a congregation that is perhaps entirely white, maybe situated in a community that is largely white, of which there still are communities like that, of course, across the country, there is still a possibility to do that work, right? So I think sometimes I hear, oh, well, we're all white. We can't do anti-racism work. You know, no, could not be further from the truth. You know, there's absolutely work to be done and really important work that has to happen within those communities as well.
Mm-hmm. But that's really important to separate those two pieces of it. You mentioned a minute ago the team that you're working with. I wondered if you could describe how you've organized your congregation to do this work and what that's involved.
Sure. So I just finished up 10 years at the Washington Ethical Society, so I'm starting my 11th year. And it has been a process of bringing folks doing anti-racism and anti-oppression work from sort of the fringes, you know, like, oh, that committee over there, mm-hmm. and really moving that work into the center of the congregation's life. And I want to be really clear I should have said this at the very beginning, like, we're still in process. We mess up plenty. I personally mess up plenty. You know, for me, this is very much a continuing, unfolding learning. So, however, in those 10 years, we have seen movement from sort of the fringes into the center of the congregation. And there were a couple times that were, you know, we started offering trainings, more and more people took them. You kind of get to that tipping point where a certain percentage has engaged in some kind of training around racism or around white privilege, or we started a people of color group, we talked about it more and more on Sunday mornings, all of those pieces. And then there were two things that I think were particularly important. So we have a mid-year retreat every year that includes the board and the staff and key lay leaders. And 2 years ago at that retreat, one of the three focus goals identified was work specifically for the congregation to do internally around assessing where we were on anti-racism and anti-oppression and multicultural work. So it was articulated as a core goal of the congregation. And we base our programming on those goals. We base our budgeting on those goals. You know, they're really central. So because of that then allowed me to direct my time resources and other staff resources and volunteer resources to create two teams that went forward on that assessment. Mm-hmm. So one of the teams did essentially a survey of the congregation, trying to get a sense of where people were with this work. Had they engaged with it? Did they want to engage with it? Did they like the techniques we were using? Did they wish we did something different when we were doing education or small groups or conversations about this? And that is still unfolding. People had lots of reactions. It was a very long survey. We were very excited. So many people stuck with taking it, you know. And now we're kind of moving into a process of talking about it.
So that team is on assessment.
That's assessment, mm-hmm. exactly. And then we created an audit team, and the audit team was charged with looking at the congregation kind of top to bottom, our bylaws, our hiring policies, our employee manual, so the documents, also the stories we used in our Sunday school program. The speakers on Sunday morning, if it wasn't me speaking, who were we inviting? What other clergy were coming? Were they people of color? Were they white people? What kind of music were we singing? You know, what were the images on our website that we used? Really trying to look as deeply and as broadly as possible in the congregation to audit for systemic racism, to give us a sense of how we were doing with that. And they looked at other oppressions as well. They looked a little bit at gender equity. They looked a little bit at ableism and things like that. So like an example is one of the things that they found, the group that was looking at Sunday morning. We use earworm mics, you know. I call it like my Lady Gaga mic, you know, it hooks over my ear and comes right in front. Well, we have two of those mics, and I use one, and if we have a guest, the guest uses one, and they're both essentially peach colored.
Right.
So, you know, seems like a little thing. It's not a little thing. It's a big thing. It tells a story about who we expect to have a central voice on Sunday morning. And so that's the kind of thing that the audit team was looking for. We felt really strongly that that audit team in particular needed to be at least half people of color. And so when we were recruiting folks for the team, that's what we were recruiting for, and we were able to do that. And then they kind of divided off. Two people would take a lead in different sections, and they brought it all together, created a report. And that's still, the report's done, and they're now kind of in the process of looking again, and they'll do kind of a follow-up in 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Can you give a couple more examples of things that you discovered maybe that surprised you or that rose, you know, maybe were things that you thought weren't important that all of a sudden rose to attention because of this deliberate inquiry?
Absolutely. So hiring policies and job descriptions. We took a look at, first of all, we're a congregation of about 340 members. We're right moving into that program size place. And so just in general, we often are not quite there with our written policies yet, right? You know, it's sort of stuck in someone's head, or we've always sort of done it that way. We kind of know how to do it.
I think bigger churches have that problem too.
That may be, right? That may be a human problem, perhaps. And so so we started looking at, well, what are the practices around hiring? You know, what do we ask candidates? And out of that audit process came a recommendation, which has now been put into place, that that there be clear hiring policies around where do we advertise, who is on the hiring team. So the hiring team has to have a person of color on it. That person of color is not expected to hold the portfolio of noticing race or racism. They're just a member of the hiring team, but that's now required for a hiring team at the congregation. We also built into the hiring policy a quota for what percentage of the candidate pool needed to be people of color before we moved to the next level in the hiring process. So we were really careful around legality and what you can do. But what we wanted, you know, we live in an incredibly diverse city here in Washington, D.C. It should not be hard to meet that quota, right? That's who's in our city. That's who makes up our city. And we wanted to be super intentional. At one point, someone in the process said, well, that might be hard. We might not be able to move forward. And I said, no, that's the point. Like, the point is that it should stop us from doing what we've always done and require us to slow down and be more thoughtful, because that's how you disrupt systems of oppression, right? So hiring policy was one thing that really rose to the surface. In general, a lot of what we found was we had sometimes, you know, good stuff had been happening. The staff has, you know, a general commitment to this work. And so the stories shared with our children are often multiracial, feature characters from a variety of different backgrounds. The music chosen is from a variety of different backgrounds. But we didn't have anything kind of institutionalized around it. It was based on the personal commitments of the folks that were running those portfolios. Right. And so there was a lot of, well, what can we do to make sure that we institutionalize this so that it becomes part of the fabric of the congregation? And I really appreciated that. One of the things that I had done before the audit and assessment started, so a couple of years back, so I'm white and I speak, I'm the, you know, the most frequent person preaching on Sunday morning. And I had been wanting to bring in more voices of color. And so, I'd sort of like try to remember to do that when I invited guests to come and speak on Sunday morning. Well, I realized that trying to remember to do it wasn't exactly working the way I wished it would. And so I just said, well, here's the deal. Once a month, the main speaker on Sunday morning has to be a person of color. Well, that really changes how I make invitations. I am lucky to be in an area, to be in DC, to have colleagues that I'm connected to so that I have a wide variety of folks to invite, you know, to be on that guest list who are amazing and bring, you know, just whatever it is that they're passionate about. But having that requirement just internally for myself, you know, nobody was holding me to it, but it really helped me to shift how I was doing our Sunday morning programming. And so that was another example of something, that intentionality that was required to shake me out of just, you know, like meaning to do well, but not quite making it.
Right. So having explicit goals.
That's right.
I mean, I'm hearing you talk about really reshaping policies and creating expectations. That kind of sounds kind of legalistic to me.
Well, we are in Washington, Anne.
Yeah, I know. but I would imagine there's also a more broad brush piece of this where you're really creating a cultural consensus around the awareness and importance. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, it's more than just making rules.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and that, I think that's where Sunday morning is so important, right? You know, the reason that I started with that, with the voices that were centered on Sunday morning, is that is our spiritual gathering time. You know, that's when messages of deep ethical importance of our core values are shared. And so that's our front lines of cultural experience in the congregation, right? So there might be a rule that helps me sort of internally figure out that programming, but of course what happens with it is much deeper. You're absolutely right.
Right. Yeah. Where have you experienced pushback, or what's been a rub in this?
You know, I think with any community of several hundred people, you've got folks that are all over the spectrum in terms of comfort level, right? Everyone in my congregation has some commitment to this work, or they wouldn't be in the congregation. And we all have come from different backgrounds, different generations, different language that we might prefer. I started at the very beginning by saying, you know, there's some folks in my congregation that feel like anti-racism is this negative language. Why do we have to use that language? Can't we say something more positive? You know, and so I was talking with someone recently who talked about, you know, if there's a spectrum of 1 to 10, you know, where 10 is the most deeply committed radical voice around oppression, right? And 1 is actively reinforcing systems of oppression, you know, intentionally reinforcing them. This person said, well, I feel like I'm kind of an 8, and sometimes I feel like people here are all 10s, and am I allowed to be an 8 here? And I think that was such a helpful thing for me to hear, because I do think sometimes we're kind of running around as 10s or wishing to be 10s. And again, I want to be really clear, imperfectly being 10s, right? You know, that might be the number of our commitment, but not our capacity. But making space to ensure that the folks of goodwill and commitment who aren't quite there on the language or maybe some of the techniques still feel like they're part of the community and the conversation, that there's still place for someone who is mostly right now seeking pastoral engagement, and their heart right now is not specifically around this work, can they still be part of the community, even as this remains a core priority for the leadership of the congregation? I think that's been some of the space where we've had conversations among us that really continue. I mean, again, it's there's no finished product here, right?
Yeah, that actually leads me to another question that I was going to ask, and that is, I mean, your congregation is one that already is progressive in orientation, mm-hmm. probably already had as an espoused value, at least, a commitment to racial justice mm-hmm. and being activist on issues like this. Mm-hmm. For congregations where maybe the entire congregation is a three or a four or
right.
a five,
yeah.
they're going to be starting this at a different place.
Oh, yeah.
Because I did want to ask you what recommendations you have for other congregations that might want to begin this kind of mm-hmm. work, knowing that other congregations are going to be beginning probably at a different point.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I do think about what we sort of, where we started 10 years ago, which was kind of trying to have resources available for people as they wanted to engage. So, you know, hey, here's a training, you know, if you're interested, you might want to show up to it. It was on the fringes, and that allowed people to engage as they were ready. And I think there are also, we've had good luck with things like movies or book groups, conversations, things that feel personal and relationship building for folks. You know, a congregation where most folks are, let's say, a 3, 4, 5 kind of space, right? They're not going to be doing an audit looking for systemic racism within their bylaws. You know, that is just not the space where they're going to be. And it would not work if the leader pushed that forward, right? But they might be able to engage in maybe one of the sort of popular books around systemic racism, talk about it, think about it, what are reactions? There's so many resources out there, mm-hmm. Even with discussion guides along with them online. And I have to say, I think so often of something that Lovett Weems said when I was in seminary here at Wesley, that still comes back to me. I can picture him saying it. He was talking about serving a congregation and during sort of the integration of the church, essentially, and the congregation was entirely white, and there was a black family who had asked, could I come to this church? And he wasn't sure if the church would be open to it. In fact, he sort of thought that some of the church might not be. This was many years ago. And so he said to the church, I'm so proud that you're the kind of church that would be able to welcome this family in. He essentially invited us to, as clergy, as ministers, to tell the church how ready they were, how wonderful they were, how welcoming they were, and invite them to live into that
right.
Possibility. And I do think that that just still sticks with me.
Sure.
And I think that's a way to be invitational about this work.
Mm-hmm. So creating an expectation, mm-hmm. a positive expectation.
That's right. Yeah.
Is a way a leader can frame mm-hmm. this exercise mm-hmm. For a congregation. That actually leads me to another question that I had is, what's your ultimate vision in this work? Mm-hmm. I mean, how would you know if you had accomplished your objective, or can it ever be accomplished?
Yeah, maybe it never can. I was working with a team of folks on a workshop around this this work, and we needed a title for the workshop. I was at a conference, and I said, "How about anti-racism work, the journey that never ends?" And they told me it sounded too depressing. But I think there's something to that. I mean, it took us a really long time, centuries, to get here. And so it's not as though we're going to be able to, you know, solve the racist structures and systems in the broader society that therefore are part of also any predominantly white institution in America in, you know, 5 years or the length of a board term or something like that. I think for me, it's about when folks come into the congregation, do they feel that it is a congregation that is learning to do better? Do they feel that it's a congregation where folks are seeking to welcome seeking to break down barriers and bridges. When people of color come into the congregation for the first time, can they see themselves there? Literally, right? Some of that is around who, you know, leadership on Sunday morning. Who literally do they see themselves there? And can they imagine themselves there? Can they feel that this is a place where they could explore, experience relative safety, experience welcome? And I do think it's about being on the journey with each other, which means being able to navigate inevitable mistakes and missteps and pain caused, right? That's part of it as well. So I think that's a core piece about being sort of a constantly learning community. Do we have a commitment and a desire to change and to do this work?
Yeah. I mean, I've been doing a fair amount of reading on this subject, and I think in my more pessimistic moments, I wonder whether there's just an element of human nature and an element of the tendency for people to have to define themselves
sure.
in certain ways
sure.
that just leads itself to creating divisions.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are ever fortunate enough to be able to move beyond race being the thing that most divides us, will we then have to
we'll
worry about political, you know, political ideology
mm-hmm.
or income inequality
mm-hmm.
or, you know, gender or something else that is going to become the ism that
sure.
that dominates.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, I think yes, right? You know, I think it's kind of clear there's something innate in human nature, in our wiring, that that creates, for lack of a better word, sort of tribalism, right? You know, these are my people and those are other people that aren't my people. And I'm sure that there are all kinds of reasons that has served us well in past times, and it doesn't serve us well now. And so I think even as there's that part of who we are, there's also this other part. I mean, I would say, you know, it's our core moral grounding. It's our spiritual grounding. It is that love that we feel called to. You know, what are we doing in church or in a congregation if not trying to answer the call of that
right.
love?
Yeah.
And even when it seems as though everything in ourselves and in society is built up against the call of that love, we're still showing up hoping for something.
Right. And to put it in theological terms, I mean, the human tendency to divide
right.
is
mm-hmm.
a nature of our brokenness
mm-hmm.
or, to put it in
mm-hmm.
theological terms, our
mm-hmm.
our sinfulness, and that we are also inherently called to
yeah.
a higher expression of unity.
Right, right. Which we feel, right?
Right.
I mean, I do community organizing, and people are always asking, like, where's your anger? You know, where does your anger come from? And my personality is much more one of being moved by the possibility. And so we all have had those moments where you suddenly feel dramatically connected to a stranger in a way that you cannot understand. You know, you're singing next to them in church, or you're at a protest with them, or you're in the shopping mall and you catch the eye of another mother, you know, with her child throwing a temper tantrum, right? And you have a moment of human connection. And to me, that's the moment where we realize that all of those divisions are, just as you say, are our brokenness. They're not real. Those aren't true. The true thing is that we're connected to each other. And so we have then, you know, a duty to try to have that real, that true thing
yeah.
reflected in the world.
So back to my question about ultimate vision, I mean, I think being able to recognize a name that,
mm-hmm.
that awareness of transcendence that comes
yeah.
in our sense of connectedness to other, as imperfect as it may be, there are times when we glimpse that.
That's right.
And pointing that out, being able to point that to people, aspire to it, help people see the value in getting to that place, really is the vision.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right.
Wow.
Yeah. And folks are so hungry for it. I mean, there is nothing like the feeling of, oh my goodness, I can almost see it. Mm-hmm. and it's what makes the you know, quote unquote work worth it, right? Yeah. That there is that possibility.
Mm-hmm. To begin to draw this to a close, since this is the never-ending journey, how do you see sustaining this over time? Because in my experience, at least, you know, congregations are always ready to, you know, jump on the next new idea or the next hot topic.
Right.
How do you see yourself being able to sustain this over the long haul?
Right. Well, I think that goes back to what you had mentioned earlier around kind of really culture, right? Cultural change. Can it become woven into the fabric of the community in some really deep way? And I think in some ways that's where our history is helpful in the congregation I serve. You know, we've got a history of working on civil rights in the 60s, and many of our churches do, you know. And so being able to remember that that's who we have been, and that this is not something radically new, this is not a huge departure, this is continuing that story of who we have been. And it may look different in the future, but it's going to be the same story. We are still a people trying to see that connection to each other, the connection across the divisions that don't really exist, the divisions that society puts up, right? I think that's part of it. I think the relationships are super important, and seeing each person. I mean, the other thing that this work helps us to do is to see people in their individual fullness. So even as I say, the divisions that don't really exist, right? Well, they are how we experience the world now. And so seeing people fully with all of their identities that they carry, the ways that they matter in the world, the ways that they're marginalized, that helps us to see them. And seeing someone fully helps us to be in relationship, and, you know, vice versa, having you see me fully, right? So I think there's a relationship piece that is super important. And while this is all happening, the congregation has to also just still be the congregation, right? So one of the things that makes me most excited is when I see some of this work woven into our celebrations, into the music that we choose, into we do a stone soup story every November before Thanksgiving, and you know, when it shows up in our stone soup story, right, that's when you know that it's become embodied in the congregation in a particular way. When you read the stories of your tradition with this lens on and they're enriched by the lens, to me, that's the lasting power, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any final words of advice or hope that you'd want to offer to people on this subject?
Well, I will say I have had I've had a really good time working with leaders on this. The experience of clarity that we are not where we want to be and there's somewhere else we are trying to get to is exciting. I mean, that's an exciting experience. And to be surrounded by people who are so committed and engaged in doing that work, it's really fun. There's just an energy there that the process of the work itself is energizing, not the end point, but the process of doing it. I think that's been really valuable.
Yeah, I think that's a really good word, because I think so many people are sort of afraid of the conversations, or, you know, they see it as a problem that needs to be corrected, but being able to see it as an affirmative, a positive process, you know, I think is a wonderful word, that this doesn't have to be scary or off-putting or intimidating, or that this really can be a fun discovery, eye-opening way of coming at things. I think that's a wonderful word of hope. Well, I want to thank you for sharing this with our listeners. Thank you for the great work that you're doing here in your congregation on this issue of anti-racism, but the work that you're doing more broadly here in our Washington community. So thanks for taking the time to talk to us today, and
it's
thanks so
pleasure.
Much for sharing.
My pleasure. Struggle continues.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by the Connect With Your Neighbors Video Toolkit, providing resources and strategies to help you improve worship attendance. Connect With Your Neighbors is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com. On the next Leading Ideas Talks, Ann Michael speaks with Mike McCurry, former White House Press Secretary and Director of Wesley Theological Seminary's Center for Public Theology, about how people of faith can bring their values to work in government and the public square.
Politics and faith do connect one way or another in this country. And, you know, it's kind of unique. We in a lot of European democracies, you don't see that connection between faith and the way people act in the public square. But I think we are trying to bridge that difference now and find exciting ways in which people of faith can engage in the public square. And that's the role that we play at the Center for Public Theology.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.